Okay, before we start,
okay,
I've always wanted to do this.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Okay.
Drop the beat, Victor. All right. I'm Matt Levin.
And I'm Victor Figueroa.
And we are your co-hosts for the first inaugural grand opening of Match Volume, Annenberg Radio News.
Woo!
First and only interview podcast.
Yes, yes, yes. So what does that mean?
I have no idea, Victor. Why don't you tell me?
All right. So we got interviews, podcasts. It's a back and forth. What we have is we have interesting people that you think their opinion matters, or at least we think their opinion matters. And we have also interesting people who just do some odd things and, you know, everything in between.
This could range from important film critics like Kenneth Turan, who we have on the show today, but also just interesting people that you've always been curious about, like someone who flips a sandwich board over and over and over, or a professional safecracker.
Yeah, people who, you know they exist, but you never really get to know how exactly they do the things that they do.
Which brings us to our very first interview on Match Volume. Victor, can I ask you, did you watch the Oscars?
I watched most of it, but I was talking to one of my friends and who is going to be on the show interviewing Kenneth Turan, and she told me that the Oscars are basically like the best campaign. You know, whoever has the best campaign wins the Oscar. Everyone votes for their own movie, so it's kind of just arbitrary. I mean, they're all good movies, that's fine, but like the best of the good movies, it's arbitrary.
And then there's also the question of who goes out and actually sees movies anymore, which our first guest, Kenneth Turan, kind of gets into. So let's go ahead and listen. This is our reporter, Maya Williams, interviewing LA Times film critic, Kenneth Turan.
So I'll just go ahead and start with talking about the Oscars. Yeah. Did you watch the?
Oh, I watch it every year.
You watch it every year. Okay, so I'm interested in the opening number, the Neil Patrick Harris musical, pretty much extolling the history of movie magic. And then Jack Black interrupts him with his whole lament on the state of the industry. Did you have a reaction to that?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, everybody knows that what Jack Black said is complete truth. The movies have gone in a lot of different directions, and the studios, they have abandoned the adult audience. And the reason we don't have those kind of films that resonate with us the way they used to was that the studios only make them sporadically. Mm-hmm. They make them to be candidates for the Oscars. Their bread and butter, as you know, as everyone knows, and as Jack Black knows, is sequels, comic book movies, toy movies. That's what Hollywood does. And at the Oscar time, they try and pretend they do something else.
In your recent book, Not to Be Missed, where you talk about the 54 films that have affected you most, you mentioned that being a film critic these days is like crawling through the desert in search of an oasis. Has it always felt that way?
No, it's always that way. It's just that kind of the oases get fewer and further between. Always, as a film critic, I think you're going to see every film is not going to be good, even in the golden age of Hollywood, where they made a lot of films that are still classics. But it's just the batting average was higher because they were aiming at that adult audience more than they are today. You have to really love film to do this job because a lot of what you see is not very good.
So as a film critic, you're also commenting on culture just by nature. You know, there's such a huge outcry for more diversity in the industry. Do you think it's on the artistic side of it's an issue, or the institution of Hollywood as a business?
It's a risk-aversive business at its core. And I think anything different than what they've always done is viewed as a risk. And risk is something that's instinctively avoided. Though, you know, obviously from a commercial point of view, these different audiences would go to the movies and spend money. I mean, it doesn't really make sense from an economic point of view because there are all these people who want to see themselves on screen. One of the things I did, I went to a film festival in Burkina Faso, which is a big center for film. And the man who ran the festival said, you know, we want to see our images on the screen all over the world. Everyone wants to see themselves on the screen, as they should. You know, so if Hollywood was a sane business, they would be putting everyone on screen because it's good business. But they just, they haven't done it, and they don't know how to do things they haven't done for decades. Right. They don't know where to start.
That it brings up another question. I know you're a film critic, but it seems like television, on the other hand, is incorporating so much diversity with shows like Black-ish and Fresh Off the Boat. Do you have an idea as to why it might be that film hasn't embraced that?
I mean, one reason it exists is that movies left this big gap. You know, there's an adult audience that's interested in stuff like this. There's a diverse audience that's interested in diversity. They can't find it in the movies. They want to watch stuff. So television said, we can fill this gap. Also, it comes into your house, which is a different thing. A movie executive once said to me that I'm not going to make movies anymore where you have to dynamite people off their sofas to get them into the theaters. It's hard to get people to go to the movie. So it's easier to access this stuff on TV. And people are interested in it, and they don't have to take the risk and drive 30 miles to get to it.
It kind of touches on Jack Black's screens in our genes concept. Like, we're not going to the movie theaters because everything is so easily accessible on our devices. And then you also, in the beginning of your book, quote Ingmar Bergman about how film penetrates ordinary consciousness.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of this other level of connection.
Really, film is as powerful a communicative device, an empathy-creating device, as Roger said, as we have. It can do enormous things. And we in this country use it to kind of sell toys. So I can just be frustrated. And I can, you know, try and get other people frustrated too in hopes that people will listen.
To try to end on an optimistic, forward-looking note. So in hopes that maybe films can at some point elevate again to that level of piercing through the ordinary consciousness, what filmmakers are you excited to see what's coming from them next?
The filmmakers I think of are filmmakers who use genre. Jacques Audiard, a French director who did A Prophet, said this to me very explicitly when I asked him about why he made this film. He's talked about the power of genre and how genre reaches people. Christopher Nolan was a classic independent filmmaker. He now makes the biggest budget films imaginable, but they always have a real independent quirk to them. They're very personal. He can get away with doing stuff that other people can't. There are people out there. It's not like there's nothing out there. There are wonderful films out there. It's hard to get a mass audience to see them. They just are resistant. Mm-hmm. But one reason I wrote that book is that I want to shake people and say, no, they're good films. They're interesting films. They're worthwhile films. You'll like these films. Mm-hmm. They'll mean something to you. It's sad, but that's what's happening. What we can do is patronize the films that are good. And I think that's important to do because if they make money, they will make more of them. If they don't make money, they'll make less of them. It's just that simple.
So money talks.
In Hollywood, for sure.
So, Victor?
Yes, Matt?
Do you listen to WTF, the podcast that Marc Maron does?
Not very often, but I hear he's a crazy guy.
He is a little crazy, but I love that podcast. My only complaint with that podcast is that comedians and comedic actors who are already really successful and well-established, he interviews them and he kind of goes through their entire career, starting from their childhood, and kind of isolates the keys to what made them a success.
Okay, and what's the problem?
So that's really interesting, but I would be curious to listen to an interview of someone who's just starting out and you don't know whether they're going to be a success or not.
Funny you say that.
It's almost like we had that planned.
It's almost like this next piece is somehow connected to what we were just talking about.
That's crazy.
So for our next piece, we have Faith Miller. She is actually the Annenberg Radio host on Mondays, and she's talking with Caitlin Knisley. She's starting out as an improv artist.
And an aspiring improv actress here in Los Angeles who's working with the Groundlings. So let's take a listen.
Yeah, Tomcat, I gotta tell ya, I handle my men like I handle my dogs. I wrangle them to the ground and I show them who's boss, huh? Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about your improv work?
Yes. Okay, so when I was in New York, I started doing improv at Upright Citizens Brigade, which is Amy Poehler's school. And I kind of fell in love with it. It's really fun and exhilarating, and you get to just make stupid stuff up with people on stage, which is so fun. And when I kind of realized that I wanted to stay in the comedy realm, I looked into the Groundlings at in LA, which is a comedy school that a lot of famous character actors have come out of, like Kristen Wiig, Will Ferrell, Phil Hartman, all those, a lot of SNL people. And I decided that I kind of wanted to go through their program and work on character comedy.
You do have a couple of characters, I'm
assuming. Oh my.
Can you can you show us some of them?
Sure, yeah. I have a boss, like a crazy in your face like boss woman who you know, just talks and talks, so she's kind of like listen, Carrie, I love you. You're doing great here. You're my best columnist. You are amazing. But listen, once you have kids, it's all over. Trust me, what you need is a nanny. If I didn't have my nanny Rita, I don't know what I would do. Pfft, nanny Rita, that sounds like a happy hour special. Speaking of which, you got a drink? So she's just like really quick and spitfire. I have a lot of different people. I have like a really weird girl who's, she's just like really nervous. And she's just like, thank you, Steve, for spinning that bottle and landing it on me. This is my first 7 minutes in heaven, and I'm really excited to kiss you. So, yeah, I have a lot of weird voices and characters. It's fun because with that kind of world, they say to, like, hone in on a physical feature or a dialect or an accent or something and then kind of fill out the character from there. So it's a really cool way to, like, connect with these people that you're portraying.
What do you hope to do with these characters? What's your dream job?
Oh, my dream job would be Saturday Night Live for sure, which is kind of fun because with the Groundlings program, you can, if you get to a certain point with them and are performing in their company, you do a lot of times get scouted by SNL and those types of shows. So ideally, that would be my dream, is to do that. But honestly, like, I love TV as well, and I love character work, and there are a lot of opportunities for character actors in TV and film. So pretty much whatever breaks through first is kind of, you know, what I want to do. But I would say SNL is definitely the dream.
Is there anybody that inspired you to join SNL or have that be your dream?
Yeah, definitely. I would say, like, just the group of really strong women who went through in, like, the early 2000s, 90s. Like, Amy Poehler, Tina Fey, Kristen Wiig, all of them. I mean, they're just so good and they're so independent and confident, and they're not afraid to be ugly. I mean, really, with women in comedy, you get a lot of, you know, having to look a certain way and do all that, and they just completely tore down all those barriers and walls, and I think that's really awesome.
How do you get on SNL? I only know, like, the YouTube star route, so how do you do it?
There's a lot of different things you can do. I say try and do everything because you never know which one's going to get you found. I'd say just as much as you can, just perform. Get your work out there. Get people to see it. It doesn't matter if you're getting paid for it yet. Just, you know, have fun doing it, and people will eventually start to notice you.
Those are all my questions, but any parting thoughts?
Oh, follow your dreams. I don't know.
Hey, Victor.
Hey, Matt.
Tell me a little bit about your friend, Kopal Khanna.
Oh, yeah, Kopal. She's I met her initially through a documentary class that we both took last semester. You know, we were friends, kind of friendly and stuff like that, back and forth. I told her that I worked for ARN, you know, the Annenberg Radio. And then out of the blue, just a week ago, she came to me talking about how she just wrote this book.
She has a book?
Yeah, she has a book at 23 years old. And basically, it's a book centered around these two characters, a woman, 23 years old, and a child. They're both fictional characters. It's set in the backdrop of an Indian prison.
What does a 23-year-old USC grad student know about Indian prisons, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, in the summer of 2013, Kopal spent about 3 months with an NGO kind of helping the prisoners there, specifically the women. Basically, when they go into prison, they're abandoned. You know, it's almost like a scarlet letter. She's kind of helping them both while they're in prison with lawyers and once they get out of prison where they can go.
Okay, let's take a listen.
As I sit here listening to you describe the real life problems for women and children in Indian jails, I kind of find that the story is powerful enough on its own. So why write this book of fiction instead of a non-fictional account of your experiences and relating them to the problems in these jails?
Honestly, for me, it's if I see a book which is called Life in a Jail, I will probably not pick it up myself. Because what do you do? Like, everybody hears these cases every single day in the news. People in India know that the conditions in jails are not good. Our court system is not that great. They're really lacking in a lot of things. So it's probably not a book people would pick up. My idea was to make the book emotional and powerful so that when people read it, they can relate to the characters that strongly that at the end of the book, they actually feel that connect with them. So I wanted to make people understand this thing through a journey of these two people who are in the jail and the conversations they're having. They're talking about their life. They're talking about how they feel. They're talking about what they want to do. They're talking about their dreams. And these are the things which I won't be able to relate to a prisoner or a person in the jail, right? But I can relate to a student who's caught up in the jail or a 12-year-old child because I've been there. It's just about I wanted to make it really relatable so that it touches people and they actually realize what the issue is.
So hold on. You're saying that the children are living in the jail with the mother? How does that work? Why aren't anyone helping these children that are also in jail?
Yeah, it's really complicated. So it's usually that. So the mother is the one who's supposed to take care of the children. In these cases, usually the father is not earning well, is an alcoholic, is probably in the jail too. So there are a lot of these cases where the child does not have anybody, any relatives or any family members to take care of him or her. So the norm is that till the age of 13, they're supposed to live with their mothers in the jail. After that, they are sent to a children's home.
And so what inspired you to do a book with a 23-year-old and a child? Like, what inspired you for this, the fictional premise of your book?
Mm-hmm. So the child, the inspiration actually comes from somebody I met in the jail, a child that I actually met in the jail. And the story of Kali, the character, is actually somewhat the story of that child. The 23-year-old, I think it comes because I'm 23-year-old, right? So I just wanted to make it sound as real as possible. I did not want to talk about a 50-year-old because then people would be like, how do you know what happens when you're 50? You know, how do you know what one feels like when you're 50? So I wanted to talk about it from my perspective. So even though the 23-year-old is not me, but I just know what a 23-year-old would feel like in that situation.
Without giving away too much of the book, is there a specific passage that you wrote that really touched you, that you like, you're just like, man, I wrote the crap out of that. I excelled in life when I wrote that.
Yeah, so it's, so with me usually, I've been writing since like I was 10 or something, but never have I ever cried while writing. So I think there came a point when I was like more than halfway through the book and I had been really stuck. I was having a major writer's block, I think. I had my thesis to write, I had everything. And I was like, no, I need to figure out what happens to this girl now. I need to figure out. Like, there were all sorts of things going on in my head. And then I finally just sat. I remember, I think I was in London in St. James Park and I'm just writing. And I wrote, I think, 500 words straight. And then I go like, and I realize I'm crying. Like, shit, okay. I must have written something. So I think that was my moment when I'm like, okay, maybe I'm actually created something which is really close to my heart. And I think that was the one time in this entire process. I'm like, okay, I'm proud of you, Kopal. You did something. So yeah, I think that was my moment.
That is Kopal Khanna.
You got it.
Yes. Kopal Khanna here. She's a USC grad student who just wrote this wonderful book, Almost Whole. She's a pretty cool 23-year-old.
Thank you, Victor.
No problem.
So she's 23 and she's already written a book.
Yep. Already accomplished more than I've ever done in my life.
That's not true. You contributed a segment to Match Volume, the finest podcast Annenberg Radio News has ever seen.
Woo!
It's the second time you've done that.
I'm just as excited.
We want to thank everyone who contributed to this version of Match Volume.
Yeah, we'd like to thank Maya Williams.
Maya Williams.
Kopo Kana and Miss Faith Miller.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm Victor Figueroa.
And I'm Matt Levin. Come back in a couple weeks for another version. Ah, that sweet funk of Match Volume.
Yeah. See you later, everyone.
Volume. Volume. Volume.